Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
The current show is being pre-taped, because I'm scheduled to be on a honeymoon when it airs. We're actually not being on the honeymoon due to Bonnie's health. As we get more data about that, we will tell you on the air what the current status of her health is. Our guest tonight is casino cheat Richard Marcus. We've had two previous shows with him recently, talking about his book, American Roulette, which was about past posting. Tonight, we're going to be talking about another one of his books called Dirty Poker. Richard Marcus, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
It's great to be back, and I personally want to congratulate you on your impending wedding.
Thank you. Let's look at how collusion is done. Assume you, Richard Marcus, and I, Bob Dancer, want to take Richard Munchkin to the cleaners at the poker table. So how do we do this collusion-wise?
Okay, so you're asking me how we're going to get all Munchkin's munchkies and money. Okay, the way we're going to do that is we are simply going to make him put as much money in the pot as possible when either one of us have the goods, and we're going to put as little money in the pot as possible when he happens to have the goods or anybody else at the table has the goods.
All right, and what kind of information do you and I need to signal back and forth in order to do this?
Only one piece of information, the value of our hands, what our hole cards are. I have to know what your cards are. You have to know what my cards are. And through the process of the hand, the flop, the turn, and the river, where we each follow the progression of our own hand and the other person's hand. And with that information, we're armed well enough to get all Munchie's Munchkins, or Munchkin's Munchies.
Now, if you put me in the middle like that, so when you have the nuts or whatever, if you guys raise back and forth, it's going to be obvious? Aren't I going to be able to see that pretty quickly?
Well, you know, that depends on all the other elements involved. Did I lose you? Are you hearing me?
We're hearing you fine.
Okay. That depends on all the elements involved, who the player is, or how good, or we'll use you, Richard, how good a player you are, how fast you pick up on things. Good collusion teams, they have one or two backup systems of communication, different ways of indicating what the value of our hands are. We could do it by the way we place chips on cards. We could do it by the way we hold our cards, whether or not we have our hands on the cards. So, it takes a lot. It takes somebody that really knows what to look for and is really poker table wise intelligent to pick up on collusion. Almost all of the communicating between colluders is done without words and without body gestures. You know, if you see a guy rubbing his nose or pulling on his ear, or you know, that being done in a repetitive nature is going to arouse even Mr. Munchkin's suspicions. But if the colluders are, you know, suave and subtle about how they're doing it, it's not easy to pick up on them. So you'd really have to, every time you lose a hand and get suspicious, you'd have to notice something and then wait till it happens again and then see if you see the same thing. But, in my book, Dirty Poker, I really detail one particular system of communication values of hands by colluders by showing different ways chips are placed on the card, the position of the card, whether it's one or two, three chips on the card. And basically, with a combination of chips on the whole cards, it covers every single hand, and it could also go as far as to cover the suit. So if you have ace, if I have ace king suited and Bob has ace queen suited, I could actually tell him that it's that not only is it ace king, but it's ace king suited. And then when the flop comes, based on our betting patterns, Bob will know. Like let's say I have ace king of spades, and the flop comes two spades. By what I do, as far as raising the pot goes or not raising the pot goes, Bob will automatically know if my suit was spades. So virtually every detail of every hand is followed by each of the colluders through the entire progression of the hand.
So the really important question is, how much of this do you think is going on, say, in Las Vegas, in poker rooms in Las Vegas today?
It is rampant, and it will always be rampant. You know, I can't give you a percentage type answer to that, but a lot of it, because good colluding players against even good poker players have a lot the best of it. So imagine when you have good colluding players playing against tourists. In that case, besides bad runs of luck, the average player going up against two or more colluders have really no chance over the course of a few hours. You get into the long run, because colluders are looking at a good 5-7% advantage. So that's pretty huge.
How is cheating in casino poker different from cheating in online poker?
Well, first of all, the major thing is when you cheat in online poker, there's almost no risk to the cheats. Just take Russ Hamilton as an example. The methods of cheating, now what online poker has that regular casinos, brick-and-mortar casinos don't, is all the tracking programs and all that. So, you could easily, much easier, identify collusion against you by going through the past hands, which is something you can't do in a brick and mortar card room. Besides the high tech scams, cracking software codes and seeing opponents' hole cards and all that. Besides that, I mean, all you really can do on online poker is collude. But again, you can collude. There's so many scenarios with IP addresses. You could have eight people sitting in the same room with different IP addresses, all in the same game, or in two games, or in three games, or in four games. It gets very sophisticated. So, like in brick and mortar poker rooms, the number one, by far, the most common cheating form in online poker is also collusion.
I'd like to go back to live poker for a minute. So, do you have personal knowledge of high stakes colluding teams that are operating in Las Vegas, or there are also some very big clubs in Southern California? Do you have personal knowledge of high stakes teams that are operating today?
I will tell you this. I am currently working for a casino and for a client who was defrauded by collusion out of several million dollars over the past 4 years. The case is going to go to court because there's a whole bunch of lawsuits involved in this. And this particular game, I would estimate, is within the top five biggest live poker games in the world. Besides that, the way I came about this huge colluding scam was not from me. I was contacted by lawyers. So I did not have any firsthand knowledge of this. I am in the process of reviewing video footage of this game. And when it is all over, I will be, of course, blogging about it. Apart from that, the personal knowledge, I dabbled in in poker collusion in my day, both online and off. It wasn't my big thing. I was more interested in cheating casinos and not individual people. I get constant emails from people describing you know, how they were colluded against, how they were beaten by collusion. And, you know, I do read them, and most of them, at least to a certain degree, ring true, because, you know, the telltale signs of the average collusion teams are basically the same. But, you know, I can't identify certain teams for you right now, but I know that they are definitely out there. And California is probably, you mentioned it, it's probably the biggest place, the biggest market in the world for, or I should say gravy train in the world for professional collusion teams. And then would come probably Las Vegas, and then Mississippi and Atlantic City. And it's all, you know, it's going on in Europe and Asia, all over the world.
Now, Guy Libertor, who owns the Cirque du Soleil shows, was in the news within the last few weeks claiming that he had been cheated out of millions of dollars through this method. He said that the other players were colluding against him. Now, obviously, if you're working on his case, you can't, you know, I guess, talk about it. But are you familiar with his case?
All right, can you repeat the name again? Obviously, I don't think it's my case, but can you repeat the name again?
His name is Guy Libertor, the guy who Cirque du Soleil shows.
Oh no, the guy from Quebec you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it's not. I am not involved in that case at all. I have not even heard of it.
Okay, yeah. He was in the news within the last couple of weeks. He has come out to say that he feels he's been cheated out of millions of dollars, that the other players at the table basically were colluding against him, you know, soft playing against each other, but not against him.
Did he make, is he bringing that to a lawsuit or anything? Is he doing anything about it?
I haven't heard anything about a lawsuit. Have you, Bob?
I haven't heard anything about a lawsuit, but... He's a very high stakes player. He's known as a big fish. In other words, he's lost, you know, $30 million or something playing poker. But he's not. He may not be world class level, but he's good. And
he's also the one who started the one drop tournament, the $100,000 buy-in.
The million dollar buy-in. Million dollar buy-in.
Or million buy-in, yeah.
Do you guys happen to know if main game involved was Hold'em or Omaha?
Hold'em.
In that case.
Texas Hold'em.
I believe he plays Hold'em.
Yes. All right, so clearly, Richard Marcus, you don't know a lot about this case, so let's go on to something else that you do know about. In your book, you talked about seeing your book was came out in 2006. So you talked about seeing a computer program in youth, which you could see somebody's hole cards on an online site. Now, since that book came out, Ultimate Bet. It's now pretty obvious that the owners of the site had such a program, and they were quite willing to use that program. Now, do you think such programs are still out there?
Okay, that story, when that happened, I almost got myself on 60 Minutes to break into with this person to actually do this, break into the software. On TV, on 60 Minutes, they pre-taped their shows, so it wouldn't have been live, but it would have been real. They backed out at the last minute because they couldn't be involved in what, you know, they interpreted as the actual commission of a crime. I then had a, speaking about Las Vegas, I believe it was right about 2006, right about when Dirty Poker came out, that I went on KLAS Las Vegas for a double interview. Two nights with George Knapp, who you all know is an investigative reporter. I don't know if he's still active out there. And we spoke about this at length. And I had told him about this, and even he, who he does have some poker knowledge, found it a bit incredulous. And then it aired, and when it aired, I believe, March 1st and March 2nd of 2006. And there was a big backlash of criticism against me and how I could open my mouth and sully the poker world without having any real evidence and this and that. And I was receiving all kinds of, you know, almost hate emails. And, you know, nobody believed. Basically, the large majority of the poker public either didn't believe me or didn't want to believe me. Then when it happened, you know, and George Knapp actually wrote a piece referring back to all this and, you know, like to say, see, he was right. And all this. Then when it happened, you know, it was a big shock to the poker world, but it really shouldn't have been, because even though online poker is, you know, by the vast majority of it is safe and secure, you know, when you have this kind of money involved, people are going to cheat. Since it's happened, you know, all the Ultimate Bet and Absolute, all the rest of them, they all, you know, they've all been preaching since it's happened how they've made improvements to their security and making their codes harder to crack, which is all true. But it just takes, you know, one key employee who knows what the improvements are to go back in there and do it again. Do I think it's happening right now? Probably not. Do I think something of its likes is going to happen again? Probably yes. You know, every time a huge mega scam hits, you know, like we're seeing now with all the Baccarat scams and all the edge sorting scams and all that, every time it makes the news and all the casinos are aware of it and everyone's aware of it online too, it tends to go through a period where all the cheats, you know, they go to sleep or they hibernate or however you want to call it. And then when the time is right, they come back again with new improved technology. And so we're going to see it again. You know, I can't measure the frequency of it's going on. But, you know, I got to believe that, you know, with all the, I don't know how many thousands of online poker sites there are now, but of all the top 100, I got to believe that somewhere on some of them, somebody's peeking at somebody else's hole cards.
Yeah, that.
So, talking about that backlash that you suffered, I don't know. Are you familiar? 10 or 15 years ago, Mike Caro did a videotaped interview with three poker cheats. The one whose name I remember is Russ Georgiev, and these three guys claim to be very involved in poker cheating. They claim that a lot of the well-known high-stakes players were cheating, and the backlash was very severe. I mean, Mike Caro, my understanding is he received death threats. Did you know those guys, and are you familiar with their story and their tape?
Yes. Russ Georgiev, I believe he died a few years ago, or at least wanted to make people believe he died. I exchanged a few emails with him. He contacted me about something. I don't really remember exactly what it was. I never really, you know, I read some of the stuff he wrote. He always, as far as what people told me, you know, everything he said was very questionable, exaggerated. But I don't know that. I do remember the Mike Carroll thing with him. I do believe that Russ Georgiev knew several people in and around big-time poker cheating, but, you know, I don't really know the details of his involvement and what's exactly true or what's not exactly true, but I guess that I just know of it all. I really have no opinion on it.
Yeah, okay.
A few minutes ago, you were talking about your George Knapp interviews. Those actually can be seen on your website, richardmarcusbooks.com. In those interviews, at one point, you predicted back in 2006 that in 10 years, internet poker would be totally gone away because there would be so many cheating scandals nobody would play. Well, it's been 8 years since then, and the internet poker industry seems to be alive and well. At least,
well, unless somebody pushes a button and blows up the world within the next 2 years, it looks like I'm going to be wrong, right?
So my question is, what kind of changes have there been in the online poker world that led your prediction to be wrong?
You know what it is, Bob? It's that it's just so big, and it's so addictive, and it's so accessible, and I guess it's kind of like sex. People's urge to gamble. I mean, you just can't live without it. And based on all that, we're gonna talk about the honest players, because obviously the cheats wouldn't be the ones who would make it stop. I guess the honest players kind of look at it as a very small risk, like getting into an airplane and the chances of the airplane crashing. That's the only answer. The online scams that we hear about, we only hear about the big ones, but all the little collusion cheating events that go on, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of them probably every week. And, you know, they don't make the news, and most of them go, you know, unnoticed. Most people that are victims to it are not aware that they're victims to it. So, you know, the only thing I could say is it's just so big. And also, back in 2006, you know, there was no Facebook. And the social media thing was at an infancy stage. So all the growth of the internet and social media and all that only favors online gaming. So it's just an explosion of you know, online this and online that can crush any kind of negativity that comes up on it. So that's got to be the answer.
You know, for us legal advantage players, when we approach a game, you know, we run numbers to find out what is the optimal play. And I'm wondering, to your knowledge, has anyone in the cheating world?
I'm losing Richard on this question. I'm not hearing him right now.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, speak a little louder.
Okay.
Please.
Okay, so what I was saying is that in the legal world, we run numbers, and I'm wondering if, to your knowledge, if anyone has analyzed mathematically how to collude and what the optimal way to collude is. Are there numbers guys out there in the cheating world?
Personally, I don't know of that. I've never done that. But you got to remember, the optimal way to collude is simply that the colluders, you know, collude the best way possible and are as smart as they possibly can be. It's just like being a great poker player. You know, the certain plays, the statistics of certain plays you make obviously are different. You being a blackjack player, it's almost like the difference between playing basic strategy blackjack or I forgot what it was called, open exposure blackjack, where you saw the dealer's hole card, the strategy changes. So that would be similar to the way the strategy would change between regular poker players and colluders. So I don't see any reason to have any numbers or percentages. It's just very simply, if you're colluding even with only one other person and you're doing it right and you have good signals and there's no mistakes transmitting the information, what you have in each other's hands, and you don't want to bet and raise and flop and all that. It's just like regular poker. Whatever that optimum percentage is, you're going to have it. So, you know, I don't see any point in having numbers on it.
You're assuming that you know what the optimal play is, that it's obvious to you. And I would be willing to bet that the correct plays are not always obvious, and you really wouldn't know what the best... I'm talking about what the best move is for the colluders. They may think they're doing the optimal thing, but I would bet that they're not. But it sounds like you're not aware of any numbers guys who work in the cheating world, although for some things there must be guys out there doing it.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point. Now that you put it like that, Maybe you and Bob should get together, and I would, I don't even know, it might be beyond my bailiwick, but maybe you and Bob should get together and come up with a basic strategy for poker colluders, because you're probably right. I'm sure the vast majority of even the best collusion teams are not making the optimum play in every situation, and I also don't know how hard it would actually be to draw that out. You know, a basic strategy in blackjack with all the computer analysis that went into that, obviously, it's probably within a very tiny, tiny fragment of 1% as far as it's, as far as deviation from accuracy goes. But I don't know how you would actually come up with that, you know, based on how many people. If Bob and I are squeezing you, like we said in the beginning of the show, what happens if there's another player in the hand, and we're actually squeezing both of you or two other players in the hand? So how would the basic strategy of collusion be, how would it be different with one other person in the pot against us, or two or three other people in the pot? So what you're saying certainly, theoretically, makes a lot of sense, but how it would be done, what computer programs would be needed is certainly beyond my bailiwick, but it's a very good thought.
That's an interesting game theory problem. I'm not the right person to solve that, but I'm sure there are people working on it. Las Vegas poker has always had its cheaters, not mentioning any players who are still alive. Most of the now dead members of the Poker Hall of Fame were accused of cheating somewhere along the way. Benny Binion, for example, was accused of murdering several people back in Texas. When you have that on your resume, a little card cheating surely wouldn't be a big deal. Is it your professional opinion that percentage-wise the games are fairer today in Las Vegas or less fair than they were 30 years ago?
That's a no-brainer. Of course they're much fairer today than they were 30 years ago. And 30 years ago they were fairer than they were 50 years ago. And, you know, in those days with Johnny Moss and Binion and Amarillo Slim and all those guys, you know, are they all dead? So can I say something without being sued?
Johnny Moss is dead. Amarillo Slim's dead.
Doyle Brunson's not dead, right?
I wouldn't say anything about Doyle Brunson.
Okay. Let's say some of the people that were around in that golden glory era of poker down on the horseshoe, I mean, the question would be not who's cheating, who's not cheating. Today, you know, the vast majority of it, just like online, is fair and square. You know, besides collusion, you know, back then you had more than collusion. Collusion was probably the least common form of cheating. You know, back then you had double dealings, dealing seconds, dealing bottoms. You had all the card mechanics, marking cards. I mean, today, basically, you know, except for a small percentage of the cases in brick and mortar card rooms, it's all collusion. So, you know, obviously, any person's individual chance of being cheated in a poker game in any licensed casino is way, 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 way less than it was as you go back in time.
Richard, I've heard these stories in California of some very high-tech poker cheating methods. One was a camera with some kind of filter there were cards that were marked that could only be seen by using this camera. Are you familiar with some of the high-tech cheating that's going on?
Well, the main high-tech cheating scam that involving marking cards that I know about and have experience with is simply placing dye on cards and seeing them through contact lenses. And in some cases, the very best of it, the actual dye on the card disappears within about a half hour, and as long as those cards do not make it up into a surveillance room with infrared equipment, there will be no evidence. That's about the best that I have seen. I have heard about what you just said about the cameras and all that. I have not had any experience or actually seen that, but it's all based on this, you know, the same technology of marking the cars with a dye that can only be seen with a specific lens, whether it's a camera lens, a contact lens. It's basically, you know, it's been around now for, you know, a good 10 years. And just like everything else, the technology of it will get better and better. And the casino's ability to detect that, you know, that they will also have to keep up with it, with the changes in technology to detect it if and when, because it's not very often that they get the chance to actually see it themselves.
You know, Advantage players, we kind of get, it's a pretty small community, so we get to know other Advantage players. Do you have kind of a wide circle of cheats that you know?
I never mixed with any cheats. You know, and like we spoke about when we were talking about American Roulette, I ran into other cheat teams in other areas because, you know, one time I stumbled onto a team on a roulette table. We were both out looking to pass post the same number, and our hands bumped. I think over the roulette lab, I think I described that on your other show. But basically, you know, if you see two or three guys in Reno that you saw two or three weeks ago in the Bahamas, that you saw two or three months before that in Europe, you know they're working, whether they're cheating or Advantage play, you know we're working. But Advantage play, don't forget, is not illegal. So, you know, nobody's really setting anybody up in most cases. When you're dealing with cheating, which any kind of organized cheating in casinos or poker rooms in most areas of the world is considered a felony. And so, you know, cheat teams tend to stay secret, tend to stay within themselves, and they try to avoid each other. Or if they happen to stumble upon each other, they try and steal or at least see what the other cheat team is doing, because maybe it could help them improve their own cheat moves. But there's no camaraderie or anything like that. At least there wasn't with my cheat teams.
What about tournament poker? That's sort of different than brick and mortar poker. That's sort of different than online poker. Do you think there is currently much cheating in tournament poker?
Okay. Tournament poker in the late 80s up and through the late 90s was loaded with professional, let's call them poker cheating syndicates, which I wrote extensively about in Dirty Poker, and took about as much heat on that as I took about on the software reading programs on online poker for seeing other people's hole cards. And I'm talking about the World Series of Poker and all the big events. Let's go back and compare the World Series of Poker in the, say, early and mid-90s to today. Today we have, what, 8 to 12,000 participants. Back then, it was several hundred. So back then, And I went as far, you know, because I couldn't mention any names when I did the book, but Dirty Poker. But if people really like got into my book and did the research and put two and two together, they could have found out who I was basically talking about. Back in the mid 90s, collusion was the big thing in the tournaments, because, you know, you would have a group of 6 or 12 players or maybe even a little bigger, 18, that would go into a collusion syndicate and all play together with the goal of getting 2, 3, or whatever of these players to the final table and having a chance at winning these tournaments. And, you know, it's always, you know, when you play in a tournament, even with 800 people, it's always harder than, you know, when you're already at the game side games, because in side games, you know, the final table is the table you're always at. But still, statistically, the collusion syndicates that worked the World Series of Poker in the mid-90s had a huge advantage, and it was well worth it to them to collude, because a group of 12 to 18 players was almost sure to get one or two of them down to the final table in every tournament. And this was done, and one thing I pointed out is that, you know, the top, if you take the top 500 players in the world, statistically speaking, how much better is number one to number 500? I mean, you know, what is the difference percentage-wise of this person's skills? Because, you know, we take the luck factor out. The luck factor in poker is huge. It's not like chess where there is no luck factor. So given that the difference in skills between the top 500 tournament players in the world is so small, and then you go back and you look at the records in the mid-90s, and you see a handful of guys winning three or four tournaments in the same World Series, you know, winning, you know, two guys winning 8 or 10 tournaments. I guess at that time, too, there were only, what, 25 or 30 events? I don't recall. But it defied statistical probability that this could happen, because even though, you know, I'm talking 600-800 players, which is small to today's field, it's still big enough to defy reality that, you know, at 800 players, you see one guy win three tournaments, you know, with an average entry of 300 or 400 players to each tournament. It's too much to believe. So I went and I analyzed that, and my conclusion was that, you know, certain very well-known bracelet winners were involved in collusion. And don't forget, with all the financial arrangements that go on, you know, one player buys half of another player, and that player sells a quarter of the player he just bought, and, you know, with all that going on. Okay, so that's how it was back then. Back now today, when we're talking about, you know, up to 10,000 entrants in the main event, it makes that collusion much, much harder. So I say yes, it's still happening today, but not nearly like it was happening then, because when you have 10,000 entrants in an event, it's going to be, you're not going to have the best of it, even if you have a collusion team of 50 people or 100 people to get to the final table, you're not going to have the best of it. And just like, you know, you'll probably never see, you know, if it keeps up, you know, I doubt we'll ever see a repeat winner of the main event when you have 5 or 10,000 entrants. So the cheating has now gone into other things, phony chips or passing off or dumping chips. And casinos, I can't remember when I just read about that. It happened recently in some tournament. It's happened a few times over the years in the Rio. The casinos do take measures. They have done stuff to correct this, and it will reduce that. But, you know, you're going to see some of that happening again. But the overall picture of tournament cheating is lower, you know, and it's so much easier for big time professional cheats to cheat the side games. Not easier, I mean, so much more lucrative, because, you know, like I mentioned, you're already at the final table every time you get into a game. So why go through the struggle of you know, trying to get to a final table? And also, don't forget, in tournament play, you're not going to see any of the these marked card scams or any of that, because even if a really good marking card team got involved in the World Series of Poker in the final event, the luck factor is so big that even, you know, knowing the guy's hole cards, you still have the odds way against you of making it to a final table, even if you're playing on some games, on some of the tables with more cards. But, you know, how would you get, every time that you move to another table, you know, how are you going to get the more cards, or how are you going to mark the cards in every table? It becomes very, very difficult, very risky, because, you know, all that scrutiny. So I would say that in the 90s, it was rampant. Today, it's very little.
All right. What about home games?
Home game.
Yeah, Richard Munchkin invites us both over to his house to play poker. What's the chance? What's the chance something funny's going on?
Well, if Richard Munchkin is having a home game, he's got to invite me so I could take a plane from wherever I am so I could cheat him out of some of his blackjack money. So that would really make the highlight of being on this show. Okay, home game. I think I wrote in Dirty Poker when I spoke about home games, about my grandfather once telling me, never play poker, or never play a home game of poker if it's not in your own backyard. And I think what he meant by that is if you're not cheating yourself in your own house, don't bother going anywhere else to play poker. Okay, so what's the first advantage? Okay, the quality of the cheats in home games, you know, is usually, you don't have to be that good to get the money because, you know, people, it's, you know, dealing, you know, the first thing you have is dealing seconds, dealing bottoms, dealing, doing this, doing that. You could have people, actually, do you guys know what shaved cards are?
Yes, Richard and I both know, but why don't you tell our audience?
Oh, well, you know, shaved cards are just simply, you have a deck of cards, and if you pull one card out and then switch it to its other side, just turn it around oblong and put it back in the deck, it has a little shave, so you can just, with your fingers, as you quickly rub along the edge of the deck, you can just pull that card right out. And that's how you bring a card to the top of the deck or put it on the bottom, whatever you want to do with it. I mean, you could actually do this in home games, and, you know, people are drinking, they don't notice it. So, you know, and there's no risk to the cheater except maybe getting into a fist fight. So, you know, the scams are usually less sophisticated. You know, you're probably going to see less collusion and more hardcore cheating scams. In Dirty Poker, I wrote a very funny story about a home game scam where they actually one known poker cheat was in the game and nobody trusted him. And what they actually did is they marked a deck of cards and they actually went into a store and put it into the store's box of cards for sale. With an iron, they repasted the paper wrapping around the deck of cards, and they staged what they did is one of the players involved in the scam kept ripping up the cards. Let me go back for a second. They marked the cards. They bought a deck of cards, took it out of the wrapping, and marked the cards, then put it back in the wrapping and brought the cards back to the store. So that night, they had the game, and one of the players pretended to be a sore loser, and every time he lost a hand, he just kept ripping up the cards. And, you know, they would yell and scream at him, especially the guy who was the mark, who would yell and scream at him, "Stop ripping up my cards." So he kept ripping up the cards, and finally they had no more cards. So now it was midnight, and there was the only store open in the town where this happened that sold the cards was this particular store. So they said, "Look, let's go buy another deck of cards." And nobody trusted. I think they marked a few of the decks. So whatever. So nobody trusted the guy to go out and buy the cards. So the guy that was not trusted sent the guy who was the mark. He sent the mark to the store, and the mark went and bought the deck of marked cards, which was in the plastic like any other new deck of cards. Brought it back to the home game, and you can figure out the rest of the story. So, you know, that was one of the good home game, we'll call it a sophisticated home game cheating scam that I read about. But like I said, most of them are just sloppy cheats, taking advantage of drunks or, you know, people that just play for leisure, not are really out there looking for money. And that's more or less how it works.
I've been playing in home games basically, you know, since high school. And, yeah, almost all the cheating I've run into is really, really amateurish and, you know, very easy to see. Everything from, you know, peeking at the cards when they deal them to shorting the pot when they're trying to throw their chips in. But I did run into one that was fairly sophisticated at the Friars Club. You know, I got invited to a game at the Friars Club and just thought it just didn't smell right. That's my experience. Is most of the home game cheating is very amateurish. But, you know, I mean, I'm not playing for big stakes in home games, so I'm sure as the stakes go up, there's more incentive to cheat and to do it well.
Well, you know what? A lot of home game cheats that are good, basically graduate to cheating public poker rooms. My partner, Pat O'Malley, which I wrote about, an American roulette, who to me was the greatest past posting claimer in the history of the world. He's in my Casino Cheats Hall of Fame, Pat Mallory. And he was actually, when we first met, you know, we were telling our childhood cheating stories and everything. And he was like cheating the clam bakes in Orange County, New York, where he grew up. And, you know, he didn't really know anything about high level brick and mortar poker cheating or casino cheating. And I taught him, and based on his charisma and his character, he was so good that he became the best actual casino cheat I ever saw. So, you know, some people do go beyond that level. And speaking about the Friars Club, I assume you're talking about the Friars Club in Manhattan. It's funny you mentioned that, because when they filmed that History Channel Breaking Vegas segment on my story, American Roulette, that's where we had the interview. It was all done at the Friars Club. So I didn't know they had poker games there, though, Richard. So next time you go back there, I'm sure you'll beat the game.
No, the game, the Friars Club I was playing in was the one in Los Angeles in Beverly Hills. But, you know, it's a private club, so they just, you know, members sometimes have card games there. So there was a very famous cheating scam back in the 60s at the Friars Club, where they had a peak in the ceiling and, you know, big stars lost millions of dollars playing gin rummy and poker there. But, you know, I was playing there maybe 10 years ago or something. I got invited to the game. And as I say, I couldn't tell exactly what was going on. I just knew it didn't smell right.
Okay, well, in any case, I'm waiting for that invitation to your home game, okay?
it may take a while to get that invitation.
Yeah.
On your website, richardmarcus.com, you have a scam of the month. About a year ago, you wrote about two people, a married couple presumably, swapping cards in poker. How did that go down?
Exactly how it sounds. There's been many, many, many amateurish attempts at it. You see it a lot on the carnival games in casinos. You know, all the different four stud, three stud, two stud, Caribbean stud, and all that. But one time out in California, I came upon a team, a man-woman team, like you said, that, you know, they would look at their hall cards, and they were sitting next to each other, and they could see each other's hall cards. They didn't have to signal what they had. And just they just, with a lightning movement, just flipped each other a card. The way they used their arms to shield it and their hands, and it was just brilliant. If Bob and I are the two cheats, and I'm holding ace three, and he's holding ace eight, and I get the ace to him, he gets the ace to me, and I get the three to him, and now I have a pair of aces. You know, that's astronomical, the edge. You know, very, very, very few people do that. I have heard of, you know, I've been emailed about several, maybe six or seven times a year I hear about that. I've only seen it twice. I've never done it. I've only seen it twice. It wouldn't be something I would have ever been interested in doing, because it's just too risky. You know, it's evidence. It's when it's done right, it's like magic. You got to practice like a magician to be able to do that. And, you know, the moves I did were not sleight of hand. My moves were all just timing, very easily done. As I think I explained on your show, that I could have had Bob, doing my moves, within the time it took to do, the physical move. Within the time it takes to air one of his shows. So, you know, that swapping card stuff it's a craft, it's an art that takes a long, long, long time to master. And like I said, there might be a few dozen people in the world that, A, are capable of doing it, and out of those, I don't know how many are actually doing it.
We have about
five. Well, if they're doing it above the table, I mean, as you say, there's evidence. They can wind back the videotape and see the cards go across. I mean, unless they're finding a way to completely hide it from the camera, which
would be
difficult.
Absolutely. They're doing. You have to do it above the table. But if nobody on the table sees it, you know, the eye in the sky is not going to catch it and then call down to the table. You know, like I mentioned in my book, American Roulette, and I may have mentioned on your show, the surveillance operators in the sky, they never, ever, ever catch anything. The people on the floor have to alert the sky to something that's going on. So to people who are skilled at swapping cards, it doesn't matter. The cameras are no factor.
Well, also, there's poker is so much more dangerous because the casino really has
no
motivation to police it very well because the money being stolen isn't from the casino, so they don't really care.
Can you repeat that? I only heard the other day. Can you repeat that again?
I was just saying that in poker, the money isn't being stolen from the casino, so surveillance is much less likely to care about what's going on at a poker table.
Yes, that's true. But even on the games, even on the house games like roulette and blackjack, they don't see anything either. They still have to be notified by people on the floor. And if you know if cheats fool the floor staff, they get out. They get away with it. But the eye in the sky is never a factor until after the fact, or somebody catches on to something while it's going on.
We have about.
I agree with that. Most things are caught in tape review. The problem you then have, though, is you may be on fire next time you walk in the door and not know it. You know, you could get away completely clean, but then they go back and review the tape, and they're waiting for you the next time.
That's correct.
All right, we have about 3 minutes to go. A lot of our listeners play poker. What would be the best things they can do to protect themselves against whatever cheating is out there?
The problem is most people that play poker, you know, are good poker players. You know, they don't put too much time into learning about how people cheat because it doesn't happen that often. So, you know, given that, the only thing they could do is just watch for something obvious, almost like the way Richard described when he walked into the Friars Club, something didn't smell right. Usually, if something doesn't smell right or look right, it isn't right. You know, I can't say to you, go in and watch for collusion, which is the most common form of cheating, because, like I mentioned earlier, there's so many forms of communication between the colluders. So, unfortunately, the players really have to depend on the staff of the casino to be on guard for that. There's really not much you can do, you know, except notice if you keep losing a pot to one or two of the same players. You notice that each time you lose a big pot, one guy raised, the other guy re-raised, and sometimes after a re-raise and a raise, they both go out. After you go out, they avoid the showdown. You know, they soft play each other. You know, besides all that obvious, there's really nothing else you can do.
So basically, be alert.
Basically.
All right. We've been talking to Richard Marcus about his book, Dirty Poker. His website is richardmarcusbooks.com. Thank you very much, Richard Marcus. Thank you very much, Richard Munchkin. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.